The views expressed on the Buckmaster Radio program are not necessarily the views of Bill Buckmaster Communications, LLC, or its sponsors.
Well, it's 12 o'clock, it's Tuesday, and this is not Bill Buckmaster. Bill Buckmaster is off in the Caribbean enjoying the sunshine, and luckily and untypically, the stock market is taking care of itself today, so I don't have to mind it. So instead of that, what we're going to do is we're going to have what I think is the fourth in our annual series of conversations with James Real. James Real is the classical music director at Arizona Public Media. We have done three of these shows when I've been substituting for Bill Buckmaster, and they've all had very good reception and been rebroadcast a couple of times. So today what we're going to do is we're going to talk with James about crossovers. What's a crossover? What I mean by that is when a classical music performer performs popular songs or popular music, or a popular music performer performs classical works, or composers do the same thing, vice versa, with each other, and confuses the heck out of us. and sometimes we like it and sometimes we don't. So we're going to have some fun with that today, and that's going to be for the entire hour. And we're having a technical difficulty. So, James, while Bob is working on getting that cut up, why don't we have a discussion about what is crossover? How does it kind of how do we see it when we hear it? How do we know that it's crossover? When do we see composers doing crossover? When do we see performers doing crossover?
Well, I think the basic definition is pretty close to what you said earlier, and it's whenever somebody who's mainly involved in one genre or one style dips a toe or a foot or dives completely into a different genre. And there are all kinds of crossovers. There are pop stars who try to sing opera arias. There are classical composers who try to be hip. There are country singers who experiment a little bit with rock and roll. It's all over the place. And the success varies depending on the training and the background of the person involved and their real sympathy for the new style.
Aha. Uh-huh. So, as you said, some of these attempts are more successful than others. And crossover can be a lot of things. For instance, we were going to start the show with a cut from Bernstein's On the Waterfront, which, of course, is the music to a movie. But it stands on its own as a piece of music, but it's kind of ambiguous. Is it classical music? Is it popular music? How do you even think about music that's written for another medium to accompany that medium?
That's right. And it shouldn't be such an issue because fans of classical music are always listening to suites drawn from scores for plays, stage plays.
Sure.
During the time of Beethoven and forward. And why should film music be any different? In the 1930s, when it really got going, most film composers were writing music in the style of Richard Strauss. So it was a classical style, and yet I think there was a little snobbery involved in not letting that popular entertainment into the concert hall. And snobbery has a lot to do with it, I think.
Yeah. You know, everybody kind of assumes that there's a kind of a stiff collar around classical music. I don't see it that way, but yeah, there is some snobbery there. Now, you mentioned Richard Strauss. The first time I heard his music, I didn't get it. I mean, it didn't go umpapa. You know, it wasn't a straight line. But after a couple of hearings, it kind of made sense. And once you get that language into your head, then it becomes, oh yeah, I get that now.
And I think that difficulty of approach is when music started to diverge. I know that you've been wondering, Shelley, if the lines haven't always been blurred. Have there always been strict categories, pigeonholes for different kinds of music? And my answer is no. For the first, 2,000 years, there were two kinds of music. Music used for sacred ritual, whether it's dancing around a fire or being in synagogue or church, and everything else. There was sacred music, there was secular, and that was the only division. And up through the time of Mozart and Haydn, these classical composers were writing dance tunes.
I think, Bob, can you bring in that on the waterfront? Yeah, there it is. Okay, why don't you just leave that under while James and I continue to talk through the segment for a while, okay? So it changed at some point.
I think Beethoven had a lot to do with that, because the experience of Beethoven's first audiences late in his career was sort of like the experience that you had with the music of Strauss. It was becoming more difficult to understand at first hearing. It was also becoming more difficult to play. So people who played dance music in the inn didn't have the chops to play Beethoven's string quartets. So the performance became more professionalized. The audience became more specialized. Even so, there was not a real prejudice against popular music in classical music circles through the 19th century. I mean, think of Dvorak writing Slavonic dances and using Bohemian folk music in his symphonies. So there still wasn't quite that divide until the 20th century came along. And even in the 1930s and 40s, you turn on the radio. Radio didn't do this in the 30s and 40s. You turn on the radio, you can leave it set to the same station all day long, and you can hear Toscanini conducting Beethoven with the NBC Symphony Orchestra. You can hear Morton Gould or Andre Castellanos doing light classics and arrangements of dance pieces. You can hear a big band playing swing music in the ballroom of some hotel, as well as all the news and drama and comedy, all on the same station. Things changed around 1950 or so.
Right. You know, you talk about when this kind of, the lines were blurred. We were just in Scandinavia for about 5 weeks, and one of the things we did in Oslo was go to the opera. And a brand new opera house in Oslo, it's absolutely spectacular. It's this public building that goes right down into the fjord. It looks like a glacier. You can walk on top of it and around it, big public space. And the opera that we saw there in Norwegian was Magic Flute, Die Zauberflöte. Norwegian with Norwegian subtitles. That was really helpful. but it was staged on Mars. So it was an outer space version. They jazzed up the dialogue, the spoken dialogue. But the reason I'm mentioning it is because when Mozart wrote that opera, he wrote it for the equivalent of a Broadway theater.
That's right.
So it was never intended to be highbrow, stiff-collar music. It was intended to be popular music.
That's right. And even 50, 75 years later, when Verdi was writing operas that didn't have dialogue, they were sung all the way through, and you needed real specialists to perform them, common people, in quotation marks, would still go to the opera. And as soon as a Verdi opera premiered, you would find hurdy-gurdy operators, organ grinders on the street, playing the latest tunes from Verdi operas.
Absolutely.
So it was, in a sense, also popular music at the same time.
Sure. So we're going to have a bunch of examples of these kinds of crossovers. What I'm going to do, go early to a break right now. Let me do some commercials, and that'll give Bob a chance to cue up our second segment. And just note for our listeners that this portion of the Buckmaster Show is presented by Mona's Danish Bakery, home of the Danish Kringle. Now, I was in Denmark a couple of weeks ago, and I can tell you there's nothing better than Danish baked goods. It's absolutely spectacular. Mona's is located on the northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise, and exciting news from Mona's is that they're now serving made-to-order hot breakfasts. Mona's is open for lunch right now, but don't go there. You're listening to the station. Go there after the program. Mona's Danish Bakery, northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise. Go to monasdanishbakery.com or buckmastershow.com for a link to Mona's Danish Bakery.
Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. craft beer, and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com. This is Bill Buckmaster. I'm passionate about travel, visiting over 100 countries in all 50 states. And when I'm ready to take off, I fly from Tucson International Airport. With 9 airlines flying nonstop to 22 destinations and easy one-stop connections, I can get virtually anywhere in the world. It's close by, convenient with competitive airfares, and there's no long drive coming back home after a long trip. Travel smart and fly Tucson. Check out flytucson.com. The Regional Transportation Authority has a 35-member Citizens Advisory Committee working to identify transportation priorities for the region and will be seeking public input on those priorities before too long. These priorities will help guide development of an RTA continuation plan. The current RTA plan and half-cent excise tax will continue through June 2026. To learn more, please visit rtamobility.com. As a small business owner, I appreciate the services of a top-notch certified public accountant. That's why Michael C. Flowers of Flowers, Rieger & Associates is the CPA firm of the Buckmaster Show. Michael's a former Small Business Leader of the Year in Tucson. He'll professionally handle all of your accounting needs and tax preparation services. Flowers, Rieger & Associates, 6125 East Grant Road, and on the web, flowersrieger.com. Cushman & Wakefield Picor is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield Picor offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at picor.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's picor.com. Call us at 748-7100.
Hey, it's Matt Russell from the Buckmaster Show.
And this is Ryan Hansen from Bon Voyage Travel.
I am so pumped to be partnering with Bon Voyage on my next culinary and cocktail cruise.
This is definitely a cruise for foodies as you experience the Mediterranean on Celebrity Cruises.
And the private excursions that your team has arranged for us? I mean, come on, an ouzo distillery tour in Greece? A food and wine day on Malta?
We'll handle everything, so all you and your guests need to do is eat, drink, and be happy.
Go to bvtravel.com/Matt Russell to learn more.
And we're back live in the studio. This is Shelley Fishman with my guest James Reel talking about classical and popular music crossovers. And the music you just heard introducing this segment is by a popular music composer by the name of Richard Rodgers, who wrote everything from 1940 to 1965, 68 on Broadway. And that was a piece that he wrote for a television program called Victory at Sea, and that segment is called Beneath the Southern Cross, except he didn't write it for that. What happened was he picked out one of the songs from a show he had earlier written called Me and Juliet and took the song No Other Love and made it a big orchestra piece.
And why not? Because nobody saw Me and Juliet.
Because nobody saw Me and Juliet. It was not a hit. It was not a hit show, but the song is gorgeous. And it's an example here of a crossover where a popular composer has been commissioned to write classical music for a television series and then uses one of his own popular songs in a very classical kind of setting.
Yeah, and it made sense too. It wasn't just arbitrary because you could tell that was a tango. And that particular sequence was for a part of the TV series about the war in the South Atlantic, so near South America. That was the South Atlantic that they were in.
Beneath the Southern Cross, right. Yes,
right.
Exactly.
And so he'd used the tango for a little Latin American flavor. beneath the Southern Cross.
That's a good
so,
point.
So right. it wasn't arbitrary. He wasn't just grabbing something out of the wastebasket to toss onto TV. Yeah. He actually thought about this.
Right. It was Richard Rodgers, after all. The guy's a musical. I mean, we had talked about people who, composers, who couldn't help themselves. Every time they wrote something, it was a hummable tune. And we talked about Mozart, and we talked about Schubert, and then you threw in Leonard Bernstein and took me completely by surprise. But there are other composers who are more structural, like Beethoven or Haydn sometimes. And you can't necessarily hum or whistle their music, but with many composers, all they could do was write music that you could hum to.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they did. And Rodgers was one of the great melodic geniuses, certainly of the American musical scene. And so this song from Me and Juliet, a show that very few people saw, it was not a success, but it did make the hit parade. And there was such a thing as the hit parade. And there was a guy on television who used to sing hit parade songs for 15 minutes at a time, 15-minute shows back in the early 50s, sponsored by a cigarette company, of all things. And his name was Perry Como. And so here's Perry Como singing No Other Love.
No other love have I, only my love for you. Only the dream we knew. No other love. Watching the night go by, wishing that you could be.
So I'd love to listen to the whole thing, but we don't have time to listen to very extended portions of these cuts. But it's the same melody. I believe it's even in the same key. Perry Como, who is not a Broadway star, I mean, he never appeared live on Broadway that I know of, had a crooning voice. You would never mistake him for an opera singer.
Right.
And he would just... You know, the joke was Perry Como because he was that relaxed, but does a very creditable job with this song. We're going to hear another cut by another singer later in the program of the Schubert Ave Maria. I learned the Ave Maria from listening to a 78 of Perry Como singing it.
Really?
So again, even Perry Como is doing crossovers.
Well, let me go back to something I was talking about earlier in the show, and that we're talking about Perry Como around 1950, early 1950s, right. And that's when things started to compartmentalize, because Perry Como could sing all this hit parade material, and it would be part of a common language. But with the development of bebop and jazz spinning
yes.
off, and the development of rock and roll and popular music, they went off in new directions that didn't really feel compatible with the other music that was in the air. And radio stations began to specialize their formats more and more. You would tune to one station for rock and roll. You would tune to a different station for what they used to call hillbilly music. Something different on each station. You'd leave the station on all day long, and it would be the same kind of music. And it's still that way today. And so people are more compartmentalized in their listening, just as the radio stations are compartmentalized in their programming.
You wonder what prompted which. Did the compartmentalization of radio stations evolve from people's need to separate those forms of music, or did the radio stations, by breaking off, kind of help the public form tastes that were very secular?
Well, those were specialized kinds of music that were rejected by a large part of the population. And so they had to take refuge in a special place on the radio dial. Then they became hugely popular. Well, at least rock and roll did. And they took over.
So would you consider Billy Joel to be a rock composer and musician?
No, definitely. Yeah. Soft rock. Yeah.
Soft rock. Okay. You want to be surprised a little bit?
Surprise me.
Okay. Here's an invention by Billy Joel.
Thank you.
You know, that sounds like a fellow named Johann Sebastian Bach to me.
Gosh. So Billy Joel, who we discovered last year pilfering off Beethoven in the second movement of the Pathetique in one of his songs, literally note for note, now he writes a whole series of inventions that sound an awful lot like Bach. And just to prove that, we're going to play a cut from one of Bach's inventions. The pianist here is Glenn Gould. So we did it again. It's the same key. We didn't do that deliberately, but I love it when it works. James, and I'm with James Real, who knows more about classical music and the various aspects of classical music through, you know, 400 or 500 years than anybody I know.
You need more friends, shall we?
I need more friends. So tell me a little bit about the similarities and differences in what you just heard.
Well, Bach called that a two-part invention. He wrote 15 of them, and they're basically exercises to, first of all, help the keyboard player learn how to move the hands independently, each one having its own line, its own melodic line. So it's not the left hand playing a few chords to support the melody in the right hand. So you got two lines going on at the same time. And that was very important to Bach because he would write fugues and all sorts of other things involving counterpoint, which was not just chords and melody, but different strands of melody all at the same time. Billy Joel, who grew up in the chords plus melody business, right, as a popular songwriter, was trying his hand at this sort of two-part invention, keeping two thoughts going at the same time.
And having played both of those pieces, I can tell you, they're equally difficult. Just splitting your head, you know, your mind in two pieces and letting both voices kind of come out equally. That the Billy Joel piece, though my piano teacher says it's not as well composed as the Bach pieces, I think it's pretty good. let's do a couple of more examples of this. We're gonna listen to some George Gershwin, who is another one of those American musical melodic geniuses who happened to have written an opera. The opera is called Porgy and Bess, and we're going to hear a cut called Summertime, and the singer is Leontine Price, who was one of the leading sopranos of the late 50s and 60s. And we're going to go right from that cut into some music by Bizet, and I've got a question mark in my notes here, because this music is from a movie called Carmen Jones, which was an adaptation of a Bizet opera called Carmen, and the singer is Dorothy Dandridge. So what we're going to do is start with Summertime and then play these two pieces of quasi-operatic music back to back. So there's lots of reasons for putting these two pieces together. They're both melodies from operas. In one case, in the case of Carmen, of course, Bizet was a very significant classical music composer.
Right.
But he was also doing a lot of popular music in France. And it was operetta. and stuff that he intended to be easily accessible. Gershwin, of course, was easily accessible because he was writing music for Broadway. And did he write anything for the movies specifically?
Yeah, he did. He did.
But my first introduction to Porgy and Bess was Leontine Price. My first introduction to Carmen was also Leontine Price. She made a recording. Now, Carmen is typically a mezzo-soprano role, not a soprano role, but Price recorded it and recorded it brilliantly. So putting these two things together, of course, was kind of interesting for me. What do you think?
Well, Shelley, first I'm going to complicate things by pointing out that in Carmen Jones, starring the voice of not Dorothy Dandridge, as it was Dorothy Dandridge's face, and that was Dorothy Dandridge's body.
I thought it was.
But
she.
The singing voice, was actually a young person named Marilyn Horne.
No.
Yes.
Of course I did hear. Okay, you did complicate it. Now, okay, so there's a crossover.
But what is really interesting to me is we heard Leontine Price singing Summertime with that big voice.
Right.
That controlled vibrato, a lot of power behind it. Even though she wasn't overpowering the song, you could tell that there was a lot coming out of her. With the person we thought, we're meant to think, was Dorothy Dandridge singing in Carmen Jones, that was Marilyn Horne scaling back. So it was more like she was singing in a cabaret, which was appropriate for the scene.
We should introduce Marilyn Horne a little bit since we've brought her up.
She was a big opera star in years following that movie.
One of the greatest mezzos I've ever seen on stage. I mean, this was a woman whose technique was spectacularly proficient. She could sing. She was a great comedian on stage in comic roles, and also sang some of the dramatic mezzo roles as well in opera.
She was a mezzo with high notes,
so she was really
versatile.
Absolutely. We should mention that there are some other differences that pretty much are universally true, not so much anymore because of poor acoustics in certain theaters, but... When you go to an opera, the singers are singing over the orchestra, and are typically there is no miking going on. There's no amplification. So at the Metropolitan Opera, for instance, you've got a 4,000 seat auditorium that is filled with the voices of opera singers who are not using microphones. On the Broadway stage, when the technology began to catch up with the needs of the composers, you began more and more to have Broadway shows mic'd and Broadway popular singers be able to fill the houses with their voices by using microphones. And so the vocal techniques are very different.
And this is why Ethel Merman became unfashionable, because she came up in the last years of vaudeville, and she had to belt it out because she was coming up before the invention of before microphones were used on stage, and she remained a belter all the way through her career.
One of the biggest voices you can imagine.
Yeah. She would just stand at the footlights and deliver.
Absolutely, and God, you mentioned Ethel Merman. I'm going to take a break because we have to, and we're going to come back and talk a little bit about Miss Merman because... gosh, the memories of some of the stuff that she did. She also did some crossover in a very strange way.
Let's not talk about that album. Oh, no.
You know
no,
the album
please.
I'm talking
I
about?
I know what you're talking about, yes.
The disco album.
Yes.
Oh, God, it was awful.
That and Pat Boone's heavy metal album are two things that really need to be put away.
So before we take a break, let's talk about Silver City, Grant County, New Mexico. You know, this portion of the Buckmaster show, with all the fun we're having, is presented by Silver City and Grant County, New Mexico, just 3 hours east of Tucson. So much to do in Silver City and Grant County, New Mexico, like exploring historic downtown Silver City or visiting the world-famous Cliff Dwellings National Monument. For a complete listing of the many things to do and the great places to stay, visit southwestnewmexico.org. We're going to come back with James Reel and talk more about crossovers just after this break.
Noble Hops is Tucson's original gastro pub, serving an impressive menu of craft beer and fine fare. Choose from more than 175 beers from around the world, plus wine and a full bar. Enjoy delicious soups, salads, burgers, sandwiches, hearty entrees, and more. Craft beer, fine fare, great service, and stunning views. Noble Hops, perfect for lunch, dinner, happy hour, late night, and any time in between. Open daily at La Cañada and Lambert Lane in Oro Valley.
This is Moa Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing.
And this is Bill Buckmaster. For several decades now, Moe has been my go-to expert for all my framing needs and bathroom mirrors. I trust Moe for service, professionalism, and top-of-the-line quality.
Thanks, Bill. Give us a call at 795-8226 and stop by Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing on the southwest corner of Fort Lowell and Dodge, right next to Copenhagen, and on the web at moesgallery.com.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
The average person in the USA today takes over 12 prescription medicines each year. And if you're over age 65, it is more than 17 medicines. CredibleMeds.org is a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping inform you and your healthcare providers. Over 30,000 people die each year from reactions to their medicines. Don't be one of those numbers. Be informed and stay safe. Visit CredibleMeds.org today and take control of your healthcare by taking your medicines safely.
This is Bill Buckmaster. Green Things has been the place for all things green for the Buckmaster household for many years. From 2-inch succulents to 10-foot tall palms and desert trees, Green Things has it all on 13 acres and 33 greenhouses full of plants, pottery, and gardening supplies. Visit Green Things at 3384 East River Road by the Rito Riverwalk and on the web at greenthingsaz.com.
Every day, your safety and freedom is protected by the service and sacrifice of our first responders and military. Please join us in this community effort to build the Southern Arizona Veterans and First Responders Living Memorial, a place to celebrate those who have paid the price for our freedom and those who continue to defend it today. Help create a space where these memories, past, present, and future, will live forever. Learn more and donate by visiting vfrm.org.
Told me when I was in pigtails, my mama done told me.
So we're back live. The song that led into this segment is The Blues in the Night. We'll talk about that in a second. I'm just so honored to be with James Real, who is the director of classical music at Arizona Public Media, but also president of the Arizona Friends of Chamber Music, and just this guy who's such an expert on classical music in general that doing this show now for, you know, the fourth in a series, but it's taken 4 years to do it, talking about musical crossovers. And that was the Blues in the Night, sung by a real down-to-earth kind of a jazz singer by the name of Eileen Farrell. But she wasn't a jazz singer,
not
except when she
all.
Wanted to be.
No. But, you know, she is an example of how these things can go well.
Mm-hmm.
When you adapt to whatever you're crossing over into. We were joking before the break about Ethel Merman and her disco album, which didn't make any sense because Ethel was just doing her Ethel Merman thing that she'd been doing for decades, and they put a disco beat under her.
Exactly.
It wasn't a real disco album. Eileen Farrell could come off the opera stage and adapt to make this I've Got a Right to Sing the Blues album, and she sounded at home in it. Ordinarily, you'd think, oh my gosh, I do not want to hear an opera singer do this material because the voice is all wrong, the presentation is all wrong. You know, half the time, a full-throated opera singer doesn't do song recitals of classical music all that well either, right, because they're there as if they're singing opera. They're belting it out too. But Eileen Farrell knew how to adapt for the material at hand.
Right, and she had the personality for it.
Yeah.
But the reason the album is called I've Got a Right to Sing the Blues is because there were people in the world of opera who didn't think she had a right to sing the blues, who didn't think she had a right to go on television and not sing opera, who thought that somebody singing the blues was somehow demeaning the profession. And she was proving a point. And she was a very down-to-earth lady from Staten Island, could make her point very pointedly with conductors and impresarios based around the fact that she knew that she had tremendous talent. Now, some of the roles that she was famous for at the Metropolitan Opera and worldwide in opera were the Wagnerian roles, the big voice roles. I mean, this was a big lady and a huge voice.
But when you hear her sing that song, you do not think Brunhilde.
You do not.
With the breastplate and the horned helmet. No,
you do not
at all.
She could moderate that Brunhilde kind of Valkyrie operatic sound and sing lyrical Italian opera as well. And so what we're going to do is play a cut of, again, Eileen Farrell singing O Mio Babbino Caro from Puccini's Gianni Schicchi. I hate to stop that. That's, first of all, it's a gorgeous aria, but also listen to that voice and think back to I've Got a Right to Sing the Blues and the Blues in the Night. It's almost a different person.
It almost is, and yet I think that top note that she sang in the Puccini excerpt we just heard is the note she comes in on when she's singing Blues in the Night.
Exactly.
And she just kind of drifts in on high.
Yeah, let's do another example of this because it's kind of fun. In this case, the soprano is Renee Fleming. Now, Renee Fleming is an operatic soprano. In fact, she's sung here in Tucson several times. She's going to be coming to the symphony again this coming season and doing a recital. And we're going to hear two cuts. One of a song, again, by Richard Rodgers from the show Carousel, which she starred in recently on Broadway. Don't ask me why she wanted to do 8 shows a week, but she's...
Well, I'll tell you, Shelley, okay, because Renee Fleming has been transitioning into operetta and Broadway musicals away from opera as her voice ages.
Precisely.
And so without denigrating the music, it's not as hard to sing.
Right. Absolutely. So we're going to hear her sing You'll Never Walk Alone, which is the big anthem from Carousel. And then we're going to hear her go back and sing Schubert's, not exactly opera, but it's certainly classical music, Schubert's Ave Maria.
When you walk through a storm, hold your head up high and don't be sweet silver song.
bring in another cut I hate to kind of truncate and come in the middle of, but you almost can't believe that's the same person singing those two pieces.
Mm-hmm.
If you're singing popular music, it helps to be gorgeous. And Renee Fleming is.
These days, it helps anything to be gorgeous.
Well, that's true. But you could hear her very conversational quality in You'll Never Walk Alone. Then this just ethereal voice singing the Ave Maria. Great work, and a case where, as a crossover artist, Renee Fleming made it work.
Because she adapts herself to the situation at hand.
Right.
She's not imposing her own technique, her own personality on everything uniformly.
Right, and also I think there's this element of what music did you grow up with?
Mm-hmm.
And what did you sing as a kid? People who grow up in opera, or classical music, or popular music very often spend a lifetime preparing themselves for that genre. But there are some people who grew up in one and then kind of gravitated to the other because their teacher or a coach or somebody said, you know, you really ought to be singing opera or more classical music. And then they went in that direction. I think in Renee Fleming's case, she did originally want to, she had her sights set on a more popular career on Broadway, and then at some point it just became clear that this was a voice that was made for the opera stage.
I think it was good for her to start out that way too,
sure.
Because it made her more versatile. A lot of the reason that pop's arrangements for orchestra have been so bland for so many years is classical musicians couldn't swing. They weren't trained that way.
Right.
They played it straight. They couldn't get the rhythmic swing right. That's changing now. Younger musicians are coming up. String players are studying alternative styles, as it's officially called. They're learning about country fiddling and Latin music. And so orchestras now are able to put across music in these different styles much more effectively and believably than they could in the 1950s and 60s.
Because of training.
That's right.
Absolutely. Bob, we're gonna skip the last... the last cut in this segment, because we're going to run out of time here, and we're going to go to a break. But before we do, I'm just going to talk a little bit more about Mona's Danish Bakery, and I'm going to get off script here a second, because just go back to this whole business of Danish cooking and Danish baking and why it is so important in Denmark. I mean, they are so proud of that. Turns out the story, if my guide is to be believed, which is always a little bit questionable, was that the French baker who was serving the King of Denmark at the time died. And the King of Denmark had a big party coming up and needed to find a baker to supervise the sweets for the party, and got somebody from Vienna. So the Vienna Süßigkeiten was brought into Denmark and adopted by the Danish people. And so when you are talking about Danish bakery, the origins way back are actually in Vienna, Austria, which is to say, if you go to Mona's and you have some pastries there or a meal there, you are getting the best of so many different cultures all in one. And I would recommend you do it. Just give it a try. The problem is it's addictive.
Vero Amore is Tucson's only certified authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, panini, and salad is homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino and on Dove Mountain Boulevard in Marana, plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore on the web at veroamore.com. This is Bill Buckmaster. I love travel and flying from Tucson International Airport. And when you fly Tucson, you're standing up for Tucson. When more people fly Tucson, airlines respond with more flights. And with more flights, more travelers can get here to conduct important business. It's a win for the region, and it's a win for you in time saved and money saved not traveling to an airport 2 hours away. Travel smart and fly Tucson. Check out flytucson.com. The Regional Transportation Authority's 20-year transportation plan is funded through June 2026 by a special taxing district, which is a state-established political subdivision within Pima County. The RTA plan and half-cent excise tax were voter-approved in May 2006, and the tax is collected within the district. More about RTA Citizens Advisory Committee's efforts to develop an RTA continuation plan at rtamobility.com.
Let's say you need an honest roofer. Where do you start? Better Business Bureau of Southern Arizona has more than 3,200 accredited businesses ready to help and committed to doing things right. Next time you need a trusted mechanic, plumber, AC company, or florist, go to our website, bbb.org, or call us at 520-888-6161. Better Business Bureau of Southern Arizona. We are here to help you find local companies you can trust.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and Pima politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
And we're back live in the studio. This is Shelley Fishman filling in for Bill Buckmaster, who's on vacation. And I am very grateful to have James Reel here, who is the director of classical music at Arizona Public Media and several other classical appointments and jobs and honoraria here in Tucson. And we're talking about crossovers. We're talking about classical and popular music and how the two can blend. What you just heard as the intro to this segment was Leonard Bernstein's overture to Broadway show he wrote called Candide. But I scratch my head and I question, well, now, is that really a Broadway show or is that kind of an operetta?
It's exactly that, Shelley. It's an operetta. It's in the tradition of Gilbert and Sullivan and Jacques Offenbach. It's that sort of work, which is, it's sort of parallel to what goes on Broadway. And in fact, a lot of Broadway shows in recent years have become more and more operatic in certain ways. They tend to be more sung through, less composed dialogue,
exactly, yeah.
More richly scored, even though they're using smaller groups of musicians to play those instruments. And so Candide was really a throwback to an earlier form of entertainment.
Right. Now, Bernstein, by this time, had written On the Town and Wonderful Town.
That's right.
He had not yet written West Side Story, so we know he can write a standard Broadway show, but this was kind of in the middle. And one of its stars, Barbara Cook, was young. She was an ingenue at the time. And the song that we're not going to be able to hear, Glitter and Be Gay, is a takeoff on an operatic aria from Faust called the Jewel Song.
That's right. And you find Glitter and Be Gay now being sung in opera auditions.
Absolutely.
It's all over the place now.
Right. Poor Barbara Cook had to sing that high E flat 8 times a week and talks in her biography about just how taxing that was and how difficult that role was to sing on Broadway because she didn't have the benefit of microphones. And she had to do all of that spoken dialogue as well and be on stage almost the entire time. But that's a crossover of a crossover of a crossover. And it's just incredible how these worlds blend. We're gonna do one more take before we end the show. And this is also kind of a mix of things. There's a singer around whose name is Andrea Bocelli. He is blind, as it turns out, and he has a voice that sounds like Luciano Pavarotti when he's on pitch.
Yeah.
but he's made a tremendous career by singing classical and semi-classical stuff to a popular audience, mostly European, but it's come to the States and it's very popular. He has sung operas, not really well, But we're going to listen to a song by Ernesto de Curtis. Everybody who's listening will recognize the song. And the singer is a crossover artist on his own with a really legitimate tenor voice called Andrea Bocelli.
Mare quanto è bello, spira tanto sentimento, come tua chi tiene a mente, trascetata fai suona. Guarda qual del suo giardino, sien di siesti sciurialance, lo profumo.
Fade that out and discuss that a little bit. First of all, the video of that take shows an orchestra of about 700 people. I mean, it is this huge symphony orchestra underlying and the song. So Italy has a rich history of songs that are very often sung by opera singers, but also by popular singers. If you're in Italy and you're listening to the radio, it's amazing how close the two techniques are.
Mm-hmm. And if you're an Italian tenor, an Italian opera tenor, you are expected to sing these old Neapolitan songs.
Absolutely.
As well. It sort of lightens the recital, and yet it's substantial music. You know, there's a very famous one called Funiculi Funicula that almost immediately became so prevalent in the culture that people assumed it was a folk tune, but it wasn't. It was another one of these Ernesto de Curtis compositions.
Right.
And so they live and breathe that Italian style, and Italian tenors sort of grow up with that. And this is the sort of music that Bocelli is actually very good at.
Absolutely.
The Verdi Requiem with Bocelli, no. No, stay away from that.
Stay away from that.
But this is what he does really well. And interestingly enough, sales of his CDs tend to spike just before Mother's Day because people think that their mothers will love to hear him sing. He's been on public television all the time whenever they do fundraising. And so it's true. His sales spike just before Mother's Day.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I spend a fair amount of time in Europe each year. And when you're listening to Italian language popular music, there is always a kind of a classical approach to it. The voices seem to me to be better trained.
Mm-hmm.
They're more focused. They're looser. They're out of the throat. You don't get a lot of screaming. You get this kind of plaintive sound, this loving sound that I associate with Italian opera, but you can also associate with just Latin music in general.
It's true. It's true. It's part of the culture. And in Mexico, a lot of the up-and-coming opera singers in Mexico start out as kids singing mariachi music.
Absolutely.
So that's something similar going on there.
Perfect example is Plácido Domingo.
Exactly.
Whose parents were singers, but in the word is now escaping me, not mariachi, but...
Zarzuela.
It's Zarzuela. And he grew up in that. Actually started off as a baritone, wound up as a tenor.
And now he's a baritone.
Back to a baritone, but also a conductor.
Yeah.
I mean, the musical grounding is not just, I can sing and that's what I do. There's a broader sense of where music fits into the society and where music fits into people's lifestyles in general. And that, I think, and maybe I'm just being a little bit hyperbolic here, I think that informs the crossover kind of attitude that makes it not only more acceptable, but almost compulsory.
Yeah, if you have a feeling for the style even more than training in some respects, you have to have a feeling for it, part of that culture.
Right. So as we draw to the end, I just have to once again thank you, James, for doing this show, and Bob Dio for doing what is technically has been probably one of the more challenging shows that you've done. I mean, this station does not do this kind of thing, and so I thank you very much for having done that. This is Shelley Fishman standing in or sitting in for Bill Buckmaster, who's on vacation. Next week on Tuesday, we'll be doing this again, but not with music. We'll actually be talking about the economy and econometric models with somebody from the university. So, thank you for listening. We would love to hear from you about whether you want to hear more of this kind of thing from me. But for now, have a great week.